I appreciate everybody coming out, my fellow heretics and a few others. And hopefully you'll find something useful in what I have to say. If not, you have to read the book, I guess. And the rest of you can partake of the champagne if you're disappointed. I have a website devoted to this subject, and if you go on godreconsidered.com, you'll see that it's a pretty lively discussion section under Facebook that is right below the screen, and you'll see people ask all kinds of wild questions. And so don't be shy afterwards if I haven't absolutely solved all the problems of the universe and the great mysteries, then you're welcome to ask some questions. So what I wanted to do was explain a little bit how I came to write this. And quite often when I'm interviewed, the first thing they ask is, why the hell are you writing a book about religion? You're a business reporter. And as some of you know, for quite a while, for the last 20 years at least, I've made my living interviewing people like Bill Gates and Meg Whitman, Stan Lee, and a lot of famous people on how they became successful in a very worldly way. And so when they ask that question, then I realize I fooled them, because before that career, I was a longtime heretic. And it really started in my childhood. I grew up in the 1950s in a suburb of L.A. in a Mormon family. So it was really Leave It to Beaver meets Ozzie and Harriet. But, you know, the Mormons are very much misunderstood. It is a true mystery religion like Gnosticism in many ways. It's experiential. There are supernatural manifestations. And the great literary critic Harold Bloom called it the American Gnosticism because of its emphasis on personal illumination. And that's what Gnosticism is about. So for those who don't know, the term gnosis means a certain type of spiritual insight on the truth. And the experience of gnosis is that insight that reveals something very unusual for a religious point of view about why we're here and where our real home is. Now, I was an overachieving Boy Scout and kind of a model student until I was 17, and then I had my first spiritual crisis, which really laid the foundation for much of the rest of my life. And that was, I got something in the mail about animal cruelty, and I realized that I'd never heard this addressed in my church. And so that started my search for the truth. And it turned out the Mormons actually have a great animal theology. They believe animals have souls. And that paved the way for my first book called Animals in the Gospel, and then a later one that is still on Amazon decades later called The Soul of Your Pet. And I went on to found a national newspaper when I was 22. This was my first journalistic heresy, called Vegetarian World, which I sold to Vegetarian Times, and I became an editor there. And this was long before I ever interviewed Bill Gates or anybody else. So this was my unworldly part of my journalism career that I have since hidden. So what happened, though, was at 38, I went through a major spiritual crisis, the dark night of the soul, as Christians often say. And for a variety of psychological and spiritual reasons, I had a mystical experience. And over a two-hour period, it was revealed to me, direct knowledge, that our purpose here was not set by a benevolent deity. Now, this is the great lie at the base of all Orthodox religion, which is that, you know, a good God created the world, maybe it was 6 days, maybe not, and placed us here so that we would do God's will, use our free will to do that, and we'd either go to heaven or, in the Eastern religions, we would escape our karmic fate and escape the cycle of rebirth. And through this direct knowledge, I realized that that was not the case, but I didn't know what it meant in terms of a philosophy. And that set me on a 16-year quest to find what teaching would help explain that and what would guide my life from then on. A year later, I interviewed the greatest parapsychologist I think who's ever lived, a guy named Scott Rogo. And he wrote 30 books, a youngish guy. And what I admired about him is that he wrote about the paranormal from a very objective, hard-headed standpoint. And I had a chance to spend an hour and a half with him and asked him every manner of question. And at the end, I said, you know, I've had this strange experience, and I'm trying to figure out what the truth is, what the meaning of life is. And he said, you know, Scott, after 25 years, I'm more confused than ever. But he did give me a lead on a particular story, and that became the subject of another book. And a few weeks later, he was murdered. And so I had really the only in-depth interview with Scott Rogo that had ever been done, and it was published in Fate magazine, and that set me on a career of writing about the paranormal. And I had a chance, we were discussing before this program, I got to interview and test Uri Geller and James Van Praagh, and I went to Ireland to write a story about people who had seen fairies. And right around this time, I met Sandra, who's now my wife, who was the ideal person to be part of this quest because she is one of only two people I've ever met who actually has some power as a ritual magician. So you better be nice to her. She has had a very extraordinary life and known many great leaders in the world herself. And we traveled the world and looked into religions. A Santeria ceremony in Cuba was given in our honor. We were invited to participate in Jain temple ceremonies. We went to Sarnath, where Buddha gave his first sermon. And we spent a week with the royal family in Saudi Arabia. We had a really unusual opportunity to look at other religions and try to find the truth. And we had many, as Carl Jung would say, synchronistic experiences. We call them mini miracles, very strange experiences as we traveled the world. And finally, in 2005, as some of you will remember, there was an article in LA Weekly about Bishop Heller. And I read the article and I thought, oh my God, this is what my experience was about. So Sandra said, oh yes, I've gone to his lectures many times. And she just didn't mention it to me and we didn't put two and two together. So that's how I came to this church. And that's how I came to write this book. And what I wanted to do was use my analytical skills as a reporter to try to understand what the truth is. And the truth is not really comfortable. If you're not willing to look it in the eye and embrace the facts, if you want to exercise wishful thinking, then you know, you can construct your own religion and it won't bear much with metaphysical reality. So there are 6 points that I felt were important to address in the book. And I've expanded on the ideas since I wrote this about 2 years ago under some strange circumstances, because normally I was working 80 hours a week, and suddenly I had a month free unexpectedly, and this book literally just flowed through me. And since it's been out, I've been doing interviews and interacting with people and have expanded somewhat on the ideas in the book. So the central points are, first of all, despite the title, God Reconsidered, I don't really answer directly the question of who God is, because I think unless you have a mystical direct experience, that's something you can't argue logically. I don't think there's anything to the traditional arguments for God's existence. But What I found fascinating along the way is some of the most irrational people are the so-called skeptics. The militant atheists who, you know, if they were prudent, they would call themselves agnostics. But they are so militant that they insist on philosophical materialism, which means there cannot be any other supernatural dimension or anything that we can't basically see. And this has nothing to do really with God per se. I mean, to give you an example, Sigmund Freud had so many telepathic experiences with his patients. He said ESP is just a normal thing, but not to the skeptics. They insist that ESP cannot exist. So I take three different topics in the opening chapters to show why there is, in fact, a paranormal dimension. Now, the reason the skeptics are so fierce about this is they realize it's a slippery slope. If you grant that there might be something supernatural, then that opens up the gateway to God. And they are among the most, they're very much like the fundamentalist evangelicals, quite frankly. You can't have a calm conversation with them. And it just goes to show you IQ and common sense and open-mindedness don't go together. So those were the first chapters, one on ESP, one on, believe it or not, UFOs. You would think that would be an easy thing to knock down. And I show that they distort their reports on the UFO phenomenon, whatever that is. And I don't say what it is. And then I address the question of, is there an afterlife? And after doing several books related to this, I can say one thing absolutely for sure is that we have souls and they survive death. Now, what happens after that? It appears that all the seers are feeling the cosmic elephant because you get a lot of contradictory opinions about that. And you'll see in my book on Buddhism and Hinduism, I'm a skeptic about reincarnation. I think what actually happens at the time of death is that we go into different dimensions according to our consciousness, so that you don't have to return here. There are some very logical reasons, and I know if you believe in reincarnation, which is not a dogma one way or the other among Gnostics, it's one of the many things. We're pretty much theologically anarchists, so you can kind of believe what you want, you know. But I thought it was worth exploring this because I had, from my experiences in India and looking into the questions of afterlife, I thought I would at least share these ideas, whether people agreed with me or not. Now, the core of Gnosticism, which was the core of my experience of gnosis or insight, starts with what is completely obvious to everybody, but everybody's in denial. It's like the Gnostics are the boy in the emperor's new clothes. Everybody knows something's true, but nobody is willing to admit it. And that is that when God said in the Bible in Genesis that, you know, he had created the world and it was good, that's a lie. I mean, everybody realizes that throughout human history, which maybe goes back, if you want to count the cavemen, you know, 50,000 years ago, 100,000 years ago, up until fairly recently, human beings didn't even know that there were germs. This benevolent God who created the world, supposedly, did not reveal anesthesia. You know, you'll often hear from people, well, you know, adversity is a good thing because we get some valuable life lessons from it. That's true, but there was a 50% infant mortality rate up until fairly recently. Does anybody really think that the 40,000, that the 40% of Europe that died from the Black Plague that they gain some valuable lessons from that horrible disease? Or how about cancer today? Do we really think that the now that we've got some cancer drugs and so forth, do we really think that the misery, both emotional for the family and physical for the cancer sufferers, that these things are justified? The deeper you look into this question, the more peculiar it gets. How can people claim that God is all-powerful and all-knowing, and somehow he's not responsible for how we're created, our genetics and genetic deformities? He's not responsible for earthquakes or tsunamis or anything else. It's truly a case of having hypnotized the world that people can believe in the major religions and believe that a benevolent God created us so that we could exercise our free will here. And it's an unpleasant thing to face, but until we face that, we're not going to be able to embrace the truth. As the great psychologist Carl Jung said, the Gnostics are the only ones that take evil seriously, and the other religions don't. Now, there is another odd aspect to our lives on Earth, and that is that most of our lives are pretty irrelevant. If you believe in the eternities, think about it. A third of your life is spent sleeping. A third of your life is spent commuting or working. And a third is usually spent in nonsense like reality shows or the internet or social media or, you know, some other texting your friends and that sort of thing. So it's a very peculiar situation that we've been placed on Earth. So if we are willing to admit that this is not an ideal world, then we have to ask who the creator was. And I should say here, for those who don't know, that Gnostics believe that there is a high God. He's not the kind of personal God that the Orthodox Jews and Christians and Muslims would believe in, but he's not the creator God. The creator God clearly did not have goodwill towards human beings, which is a little hard to believe. But why don't we go back to the Old Testament and see what God's really like? Now, for those of us who grew up as Christians and we read the Old Testament, we kind of read it through a strainer that made a lot of these things seem like, you know, God was mean to people, but they deserved it, or, you know, one way or another, we tried to justify these things. But quite frankly, once your eyes are opened, if you go back and read it, there are a lot of peculiar things. Like, while the rest of the world maybe was in crisis, God spent 40 days with Moses talking about the 600 different rules for the priestly garments and the importance of stoning children who were disrespectful to their parents. And you go through this whole list, and as somebody said, God, Jehovah sounds like an insecure egomaniac, which might be a description of Trump for all I know. But in any event, Christopher Hitchens, a famous atheist author, once quipped that Jehovah is the most evil character in all of fiction. And certainly when you go through the Old Testament, it does not seem like a benevolent God. For one thing, he's not very good about picking out kings. I mean, Solomon and David were all liars, mass murderers, adulterers. They set up pagan worship places while they're talking to Jehovah. It's extraordinarily inconsistent, except with one thing, and that is Gnosticism is the only religion that says that the creator God, which we call the Demiurge, was behind this. And you know, you might say, well, you know, why would a spirit have something against human beings, be evil, essentially, be malevolent? Well, first of all, shamanism throughout the world has always said that spirits are kindly towards people, or they're lost souls, they're neutral, or they're very malevolent. And the fact of the matter is, as they say in magic, as below, so above. We have our Hitlers, our Stalins, our Mao. Why should it be any different in another dimension? So that would be one way to look at it. Now, you don't have to take the concept of the demiurge literally. I happen to come from a background studying shamanism. I do believe it's an entity, but it could be an impersonal force. Some believe that it's part of the structure of our mind, that the demiurge is an impersonal force, or, you know, any number of other things. But the important thing is that this leads to the basic comment, assertion of Gnostic mythology, which is that the creation was an accident. Now, no other religion says this, but if you actually look at evolution, there is no evidence of either a god guiding evolution or even aliens. I think the aliens would be much smarter than, if you were trying to guide evolution, would you really have to wait several hundred million years for the dinosaurs evolve and then eventually say, you know, this isn't really working out, let's bring in an asteroid and start over? I don't think the aliens would be that stupid. It appears that truly this world is an accident. There's even a new book out called Lucky Planet that argues that it was a unique event in the history of the universe. There's no intelligent design. If anything, there's unintelligent design when you look at the way the eyes designed and so forth. And again, Gnosticism is the only spiritual path that teaches these things. Now, for those of you who wonder, you know, how does Gnosticism otherwise compare with traditional Christianity? The Gnostic movement was very popular in the early centuries. There were Gnostic temples found in southern China as late as the 1600s. It was a real contender to become the dominant form of Christianity. But the more important point is not who won out that battle, but when you go and look at the New Testament, the surprising thing for those of us who grew up in traditional Christianity, the surprising thing is modern Christianity is a late invention, really starting with the Nicene Council and so forth. I mean, you really can't find the Trinity in the New Testament. There are just as many scriptures that contradict that idea. The idea of the atonement is something that came later, this idea that Christ died for our sins and so forth. There's no eternal hell that seems clear in the New Testament. And most important of all, for those of you who are familiar with Bart Ehrman, who was an evangelical scholar, and he's written a number of books, including Jesus Interrupted, if you look at the central story of the Last Supper, the crucifixion, and the resurrection, the four Gospels radically contradict each other. Now, if you can't get the main storyline right between the four main writers, it obviously means they weren't eyewitnesses, and you can't really rely on the New Testament to determine your religion. So, having said all this, you know, should one be a pessimist? No. Most Gnostics actually have a good sense of humor. You can accept life. It's a paradox, but once you realize that you don't have to be anxious about, you know, becoming a success in the world, and, you know, you get the Ten Commandments off your neck, this leads actually to inner peace, and it can lead to a lack of fear of death. And also, there really are miracles that can be had by interacting with the spirits, and you can devise, as an anarchic Gnostic, you can devise a spiritual practice that may consist of going to Mass, meditation, prayer, altar work, any number of things that will magnetize synchronicities and blessings. Now, I can say for sure that Sandra and I have had extraordinary lives because we pursue a spiritual practice, And I'll give you one last little anecdote about how this has really borne on my life. And that was 3.5 years ago, I was on my way to a Thanksgiving dinner downtown. Not many people were out. And I was going through an intersection of my little Toyota Corolla, and an SUV ran a red light and totaled my car. Now, miraculously, I wasn't killed. It took me about 6 months to recover. But the real problem was that I was in shock and I didn't know what happened. And the other driver, it became quickly clear, was going to say, I ran the red light. And had he won his case, then my life would be rather different today. There was just one little cosmic fly in the ointment, and that was right at the point of impact, there was a pastor standing on the corner, about the only guy standing around, looking right at that point. And he came over to me, realized I was in shock. He gave me his card, and he said, call me tomorrow. I'll tell you what happened, and don't tell the driver that I talked with you. So he called me the next day, and he said, the other driver ran the red light. I will be a witness for you. And my insurance company said that he was the most credible witness they had ever interviewed. So I made a donation to his church out of the settlement. But these kind of incredible synchronicities do occur. Now, we don't exactly know why the divine forces don't always intervene in our lives. You know, many of you are aware of the Marian visions. At Fatima, I think 40,000 people, including many atheists, witnessed the Virgin Mary. I have no doubt from the time we've spent in Islamic countries that Muhammad talked with an angel and that became the beautifully written Arabic in the Quran. He was illiterate. Joseph Smith, I believe, had an angel come to him to reveal the Book of Mormon. As Harold Bloom said, Joseph Smith was one of the few people in history who could make other people see his visions. And I know the background. Sandra has been to some Mormon services, and she's psychic and could really feel that it was a living religion. So we don't know why the spirit doesn't always intervene on our behalf and our prayers get answered. But we do know spirits exist. And it may be that, you know, this is like a radiation or an Ebola zone. Maybe it's just physically difficult because even the lost souls don't come over here very often. There is not a lot of interaction between the worlds, but there is some. So what we want to do is try to cultivate that kind of positive energy and those blessings. And it doesn't matter whether you believe in an impersonal God or Jesus is the liberator or your ancestors. If you pray sincerely and try to maintain a spiritual life, blessings will come to you, not always the way that you might expect, and sometimes you'll have miracles. And I can say that for those of us who have had the experience of gnosis, I think it's fair to say we no longer have a fear of death. So that's my message, and if anybody has any questions, I'd be happy to answer them. Yeah. Thank you. Thanks for the opportunity. Oh, yes.
Okay, I'd like to just ask if you would consider God to be consciousness.
I am pretty sure we don't understand God, but consciousness would be one definition. I'm quite sure that not only is God beyond our conception, but it is, you know, the most of the quantum physicists, and I cite these in my book, like Einstein, believe that there was an intelligence behind the order of the universe. So it's likely that God is some kind of impersonal force that has a personal connection to this world. Now, I did have another mystical experience where I felt in the presence of Christ, and I do believe that Jesus is the enlightener and the liberator, which is the Gnostic Christian message. And that's about all I can say for sure. But I always go back to first principles, which is we have a soul, the soul survives death, and that opens the door to anything. So I don't think that we really understand exactly what happens after death. I don't think we need to worry about it, and I do think it would be prudent to behave yourself. Okay. Yes.
Like in terms of like their spiritual experience.
Yeah. Yes. Mm-hmm.
Why would there be
Great question. Why are there conflicting spirits, shall we say? Now, there's a couple of theories on this. I won't go into all the detail, but my conclusion, I think we live in a kind of shamanistic universe, and all the seers, probably the Gnostic seers too, because they didn't always agree on everything, all the details. I think what Joseph Smith said is that every religion has part of the truth, and they are feeling different parts of the elephant, but that doesn't mean that every religion has mostly the truth. They have a piece of it. I think traditional Christianity works for a lot of people. The concept of the atonement psychologically is very helpful to people. Some people probably need the strictness of Islam, and culturally, without alcohol, it has some positive things. But the fact of the matter is that we are allowed to believe in a variety of things. It's very, very hard to know the truth in this world. You know, my search around the world until I finally found my philosophy was the result of that confusion. What I tell people is, if you have a spiritual path and you're happy with it, don't read my book. I think that, this is a book to kind of make people uncomfortable. But I have a high regard for people of any faith who really live it. But I think one of my arguments against traditional concept of God is that we were put on this earth without a clear way to find the truth. You know, it's not like you can be good and then the truth comes to you. You can also make the argument, for example, that some have made, that, for example, Islam was given to the pagan tribes in the Middle East, and it was a step up from that, you know, a point of evolution. But to show you how confusing things get, the greatest psychic medium, I think, living today is George Anderson. And he's a believer in reincarnation, so he once asked the spirits, is reincarnation true? And they said, well, we've heard about it. Now, if you're already dead and you're not sure, probably there are a lot of mysteries on the other side. And I suspect, you know, the Mormons have this idea of different dimensions. They say there's no hell. So even the bad guys get into something that would look pretty good. In fact, Joseph Smith said, if you saw the lowest rung of the afterlife, you'd commit suicide to get there right now. You know, so, I don't think, when you think about the concept of hell, it really doesn't make any sense. Somebody was born before Christ or, you know, wasn't, at the door when the Jehovah's Witnesses came by, so they're going to go to hell for eternity. I mean, even trying to punish people who did evil things, you know, is there any amount of hell that is going to alleviate the 6 million Jews that went through the Holocaust? There's nothing Hitler can do if he gets enlightened, you know, to make up for that. So my feeling is that Christians, Muslims, even Gnostics, Buddhists, Hindus, we're all in for a shock when we get to the other side. And maybe that's why it's veiled, so that we don't really know what's going to happen. I think it's going to be a great adventure. Yes?
Sort of detail about your mystical experience at 38. You wanted to talk about the debut of such assurance.
Yeah. Yeah, I will say this. It came about because I had gone through first the Landmark Forum, which used to be called EST. Sandra knew Werner Erhard before he invented that, incidentally. Interesting story. And that really has a very big impact in kind of shaking up your subconscious. I had also embarked on what I thought would just be a fun research into the UFO phenomenon, and I quickly discovered that the abduction phenomenon is really very disturbing, which was ironic because Mormons, and I was Mormon at the time, believe in extraterrestrials. But I quickly concluded this was not something extraterrestrial, that it was paranormal. So I was getting increasingly disturbed by that. And that made me kind of question my faith. And then, weirdly enough, it was the coldest day I'd ever been through in Los Angeles. There was snow on the ground. And I started shivering for hours. I couldn't stop. Whatever the biochemical, psychological thing, when it came on me, it was a very physical thing. It was almost like being under the influence of a drug. But I could suddenly see, like the veil was pulled from my eyes, that each religion, I kind of went through each one, and I could see what the problem was. You know, for example, Mormons say, Mormonism is a very worldly religion in the sense that they believe in being successful here and that it helps you in the eternities. And, you know, they believe in a previous existence where our spirits were created. They say consciousness or intelligence has always been there, with the co-eternal with the gods, and anybody can become a god if they put their mind to it. And they say that we were sent here to be tested. I realized in that moment that this place is not a good test. It's hard to find out the truth, you know. But I will say this. Here's something, another odd thing I'll throw in about Mormonism. I'm doing Miguel Connor's show on Friday, and he wants me to talk about Mormonism at length. In my earlier incarnation, I helped convert somebody to Mormonism, and he wrote this great book called The Rise of the Mormons. And it's about how it's very likely that Mormonism will become the next great world religion over the next century because of its philosophical and cultural appeal. But I ended up in 2006, the year after I discovered the Gnostic Church, I went to the Sunstone Forum, which Bishop Heller has talked at, and that's the annual kind of progressive Mormon conference. And I went and talked about Gnosticism, and it's about a 12-page, closely typed discussion of the Gnostic critique of Mormonism, but also says you could be a Gnostic Mormon. You know, there's enough similarities, but that's their Achilles heel. They think this world is a great place. The Mormons are the ultimate optimists. I told you more than you wanted to know, but once I get rolling, yes.
My first profound mystical experience, it started out like with a lot of clarity and a lot of insight and seeing sort of beyond the veil, and then it went further than that and sort of ended up in nonsense and madness. And
that explains you.
And I've heard from Dr. Heller that in one of his lectures he said it's more important to prepare for opportunity than to seek it. And I was wondering if you would recommend anything to prepare to sort of have a mystical experience, or make sure you're ready when that does occur.
Well, one thing I would say is most people do not have this kind of dramatic experience. My view of Gnosis is, in most cases, it's a gradual awakening until at some point the veil drops from your eyes. It's a shift in consciousness, and suddenly you know the truth. And once that happens, there's no going back. And it's the awareness that this is not our real home. Now, you know, most people can't do what I did, which is travel the world, you know, under the guise of writing travel articles. But I will say this. Since I tried to do a really rigorous job of taking you through the journey that I went through spiritually and intellectually, when you read the book, everybody has questions. Like I say, I'm in a learning process as I'm doing this in my dialogue with readers. I'd be very interested if you go on godreconsidered.com and post your questions. You'll see there's a lot of wild questions on there. I've stirred something up, and I'll do my best to answer it. But I think that, honestly, this is another thing about Mormonism and Gnosticism. Mormonism, as some of you will know, has temple ceremonies, secret temple ceremonies, and it's all about learning to become a god. And I believe that the Eucharist, the Mass, is important. Jung, there's some great lectures by Bishop Heller on Jung's interpretation of the symbolism of the Mass and so forth. And in fact, before I became a member, he had me read a book about one person with psychic ability who saw this spiritual energy build up during the Mass. I think just coming here You partake of that. You bathe in that. I also have found for myself that meditation magnetizes extraordinary synchronicities. I could fill a book with the weird stuff that has happened to us. And so I think meditation, going to the Mass, and reading books. I've read now dozens of great books. I was talking with Winter right before about Andrew Philip Smith, who has a lot of great books out. Next to Bishop Heller, he's my favorite Gnostic writer. He also did a blurb on the back of the book, so I particularly feel grateful to him. But he's written a lot of terrific books, and I never, ever stop learning from these great books. So, I mean, it's an incredible, as a journalist, I'm used to reading like two books a week and stuff. I can't seem to get through the pile of Gnostic books. There just seems like an endless growing number of fascinating things. You know, it's like you pull back the curtain and there's another room of knowledge, you know. So you get there. And I also am a believer. I have an altar at home. I believe in prayer. I say, make up your list of the holy dead, all those who have passed on, who would wish you well, your mentors, your ancestors. I include the Gnostic seers. Who's to say how the answer comes? But it's my experience, all this stuff helps.
I don't want to prolong the session.
No.
But first I'll do something that when somebody does it to me when I'm lecturing, I always get annoyed. So I don't know whether you're going to get annoyed or not. Because, you know, people ask you a question, they give you a horse, and then they ask you, do you agree with that? So this is a little bit what I'm doing. I just want to highlight some of the keynotes in your book and see whether I read it right.
I'll let you know.
Because if not,
don't excommunicate me if I disagree.
You know, and he does something really very interesting, or so it looks to me. He starts out by sort of poking holes into the atheists. And the way he does it is, look, you guys don't want to believe in anything that you cannot test with your eyes and so forth. And look, here are the data of parapsychology. Here are the visionaries. What about this? And if this is possible, well, then maybe the others are possible too. Mm-hmm. Then from there he goes on to the religions, and he goes on to the various monotheistic religions and gives wonderful descriptions, but the conclusion is always they all somehow leave a great hiatus of meaning. And then he goes on to the polytheistic religion of Hinduism, similarly, some very wonderful things, but somehow it leaves certain things to be desired in terms of meaning. Then he goes on to the non-theistic religion of Buddhism and does the same. And then, to my very great delight and gratitude, then he brings a very nice short but excellent synopsis of Gnostic ideas and shows how these supply most, if not all, these holes, these hiatuses, which are in all these various systems. And I think that is a terrifically organized situation. So do you agree with that delusion?
As lawyers would say, I'll stipulate to that. I call it the Trojan horse approach to argument, because if you build the argument, I tell people, don't look for the punchline in the back, because you're not going to understand it. You know, if you go through the book, this is the process I went through, you know, looking at Hinduism, looking at Buddhism, and the hardest chapter of all is chapter 5, it's the hardest to think through, which is, this world actually is not a great place to discover the truth for any number of reasons. If you can get through that chapter or just stipulate that that's true and, you know, skip it over, it's not a pleasant chapter, but it is it's absolutely amazing that all religions have hypnotized people to convince them that, you know, this is a great place, you know, as long as you're paying the money in to the temple or the synagogue or the church, you know, we'll keep moving you along to, you know, the wonderful hereafter or your better next life. And it's not until you get out of that bubble, out of that trap, and this is what Gnosticism does, is it takes you out of all that propaganda, and then you look back, you know, it's a little bit like in high school or college, you were convinced you were in love. You know, you're going to marry this person. Well, after it falls apart, a few years later, you look back and you realize it was infatuation. You realize, I didn't even have anything in common with that person. You know, belief in other religions is like being infatuated. It makes sense at the time, you know. And then when you step away from this, and Gnosticism allows you to step away from all that propaganda. And, you know, my attitude is, hey, I don't want to contaminate Bishop Heller with my opinions. You know, a lot of Gnostics will totally disagree with my ideas on reincarnation and stuff. But that's okay. And I'm happy for other people to follow any spiritual path they want that works for them. But what I'm saying is it's time to push back against religious orthodoxy and not allow these idiotic atheists to monopolize that conversation. And incidentally, maybe it'll do our hearts some good. I had an absolutely hysterical reaction to the book from an atheist website. That was the initial reaction. Ironically enough, it was called, the website, believe it or not, is called Religious Tolerance. Yeah. I thought I was going to post something up there and say, hey, I'm glad you guys allowed discussion. Wow. It was unbelievable. They would do anything but read the book is what I really learned. Anybody else? I think it's time to break, and thanks for coming out, guys. Thank you.